Today's topic is entrepreneurship, and it is the fifth and final of five podcasts on that topic. All five podcasts have revolved around the question of how entrepreneurship impacts the economy. Our focus today is the paper Towards an Entrepreneurial Economy, the Entrepreneurship Industry, and the Rise of the Veblenian Entrepreneur. It's something that Anastasia Krabbe at Stanford University, Andre Spicer at Cass University, and I have written. And you really should be aware that this is a working paper and it's not yet peer-reviewed. And so it has not passed through the sort of vetting for outlandish claims and wrong-headed conclusions that peer review should, but doesn't always, provide. And while the other readings that we've covered so far represent ideas that have been accepted into what you might call a canon, this paper is, of course, emphatically not canonical. It's both way too recent and totally unproved in that regard. What it is, however, is deliberately provocative. And for these reasons, I'll try to lay out the argument somewhat more briefly and just provide some guideposts for making sense of it. And then I'd hope that the paper occasions you to make up your own mind about it. I should say that there is, by design, lots to disagree with in the paper, and I definitely invite you to do so. Now, the starting point for this paper is very much two other papers. Now, one is the one that you've read by Nightingale and Code. And specifically, it's their observation that entrepreneurial ventures end up as Muppets so much more often than they end up as gazelles. The other is a paper by Ryan Decker and a group of his colleagues that argues, without using this specific language, that Muppets are becoming more common. That paper, which is called Where Has All the Skewness Gone?, was published in the European Economic Review in 2016, and it examines the growth rates of high-growth young firms. Basically, we accept that entrepreneurial outcomes are highly skewed, and we'd expect that entrepreneurial gazelles, at the right-hand tail of the outcome distribution, do grow really fast, much faster than other young firms that grow, say, at the median rate. Now, if you look at US data, you can see that over the first decades of this century, the right-hand growth rates fell, and those firms that should have been high performers began to look much more like the sluggish ones at the median. Now, this, in other words, the skewness of the distribution, the same kind of skew that allows a very limited number of high performers to really excel, is going away, and that's a bad thing, because that means that the Muppets are becoming more common. Now, why could that be? Now, there are all kinds of economic, psychological, and sociological explanations that you could advance to explain both why there is so much low-quality entrepreneurship and why it's becoming more common. As is always the case, some of those explanations are better than others, and in reality, the phenomenon is probably overdetermined in the sense that there are just lots of factors at play, and trying to isolate one or a few explanatory variables is probably somewhat futile. This is complex, not in the sense that it's hard to understand. It's complex in the sense that there's just a lot of stuff going on at the same time. What we're trying to do in this paper, though, is to say that there's something that we're not paying enough attention to as we're trying to explain why the quality of entrepreneurship might be declining. And that thing that we're not understanding or not paying enough attention to is what's called the entrepreneurship industry. Now you've probably been exposed to some of that industry yourself firsthand. It's the company selling things, whether that be events, advice, books, office space, websites, small business software, or specifically, primarily targeted to aspiring or current entrepreneurs. You've probably been invited or forced, depending on your perspective, to take entrepreneurship classes in college. And some of you probably encountered it even before. If you're in university, there's probably an innovation hub or an entrepreneurship center or something similar on campus that's trying to support you to become an entrepreneur. You've probably seen posters advertising pitch competitions and similar events. And you've probably seen the books offering advice for how to succeed as an entrepreneur. You might also, just on primetime television, have seen The Dragon's Den, or you might have heard podcasts like The Pitch or the various spin-offs to those two concepts. These are all examples of activities happening in the entrepreneurship industry. Now, we don't actually know very much about the workings of this industry, and that's sort of what we're trying to get at in this paper, trying to create a foundations for getting to understand that. The stuff that we do know about the entrepreneurship industry is generally pretty bad news for the industry. The most comprehensive work is what Richard Hunt and Kip Kiefer present in the paper titled The Entrepreneurship Industry: Influences of the Goods and Services Marketed to Entrepreneurs, from the Journal of Small Business Management in 2017. Now, they make two interesting observations, right? One is that the global entrepreneurship industry is growing rapidly at about 12% annually, which means that it's doubling every 7 years. It's also worth, in 2014 at least, some $13 billion, which should be close to double that by now. And for comparison, it's about the same as the global surfing industry or the influencer marketing industry. Now, their second finding is that the more goods and services marketed by the entrepreneurship industry individuals consume, the more entrepreneurially active they become. Their tendency to start a venture increases. But, and that's sort of the kicker, the performance of those ventures decreases. In other words, the entrepreneurs who consume more of the industry's products become worse entrepreneurs. And that's, of course, just a little bit paradoxical. The whole purpose of the entrepreneurship industry is to support entrepreneurs in recognizing good opportunities and executing on them in an effective way. Much like how the purpose of strategy consultants is to help their clients come up with good strategies that they can implement and use to compete more effectively. We can debate whether they do that or not, of course. It'd be the same as having a environmental consultancy company that actually makes a company that they consult for produce more CO2. Now, you'd think that this was a real problem for the entrepreneurship industry then, that what it seems to do is, extrapolating a bit, is to help people find bad ideas and to not execute effectively on the good ones. You might say, what good is it to read all those entrepreneurship books, go to all those events, take all those classes, if they make you more unlikely to succeed? If, to riff a little bit on the terms in the past two papers, the entrepreneurship industry doesn't so much spur the gale of creative destruction, but in fact functions as a Muppet factory. Now, I'd argue that this maybe misses the point somewhat, however, because it assumes the entrepreneurship industry is actually meant to be a productive endeavor, that is actually intended to result in successful ventures. And I think there's a case to be made that this is not the case. It's about something else. In fact, I think it's increasingly not the case. And the reason that this is so is because of how the entrepreneurship industry has changed what it means to do entrepreneurship. It has changed the nature of entrepreneurship. It's supporting a different kind of entrepreneurship than the growth-oriented kind. And in the paper that you've read, we're trying to develop the idea that the entrepreneurship industry has actually contributed to making possible what we call Veblenian entrepreneurship. Now, you might recall the term Veblen goods from your introductory econ classes. They're goods with an upward sloping demand curve, where demand increases as prices rise, which intuitively just should not happen. They tend to be luxury goods. They're the goods that serve as status symbols. Thorstein Veblen, for whom Veblen goods are named, is famous for his book, The Theory of the Leisure Class, where he describes why rich people consume expensive things, not because they really need them, but because they want the social recognition that comes from demonstrating that they can afford expensive stuff. That's conspicuous consumption, to use his term. He also describes how people engage in conspicuous leisure activities, demonstrations of not working that are precisely intended to show off that people are wealthy enough to not need to work. Entrepreneurship, I'd argue, increasingly has become a good of this nature. It's something that people increasingly engage in simply to be able to signal that they are entrepreneurs, in scare quotes, and to reap the social recognition and status that comes from that category. It's not because they have recognized valuable opportunities or know how to execute on them. Now, two factors conspire to make this possible, right? For one, there is the obvious hyper-celebration of entrepreneurship in popular culture. And second, there is an entrepreneurship industry, as we've talked about already, that actually provides products that you can conspicuously consume to show to the world that you are in fact, or at least in your own fiction, an entrepreneur. That consumption might be much more important than the substantive work of being an entrepreneur in signaling to the world that you are in fact an entrepreneur. Now, it'd be impossible to conspicuously consume entrepreneurship absent either of these two. If it wasn't celebrated, you would not get social recognition from saying, I'm an entrepreneur, and consuming your way into that category. If there were no products, you couldn't very well signal that you were, in fact, an entrepreneur. Now, that might sound just a little bit occult, but think of the entrepreneurship as being in the business of selling dreams and identity, not functionally good products, not functionally good advice. And then compare that to how Levi's and Harley-Davidson, and in times past at least, Marlboro sold various forms of the American dream of freedom and rebellion, and not just trousers, motorcycles, or tobacco, right? There are cheaper alternatives to these products, but they're desirable precisely because of the dreams they sell, the dreams that the products are infused with. And those dreams are sold, I would argue, quite indiscriminately to people who have a decent chance of succeeding in the case of the entrepreneurship industry, and to many who have exceedingly poor chances. It's actually important to appreciate this. The entrepreneurship industry actually has a vested interest, which we sort of elaborated in the paper, in propagating the idea that anybody can succeed as an entrepreneur, quite irrespective of the statistical fact that success is just ridiculously unlikely. The people who enter into entrepreneurship with bad ideas and low skills, you might even say, are going to make better customers to the entrepreneurship industry selling advice and goods to them, right? They're going to need more help along the way. It's sort of like the middle-aged office worker who decides that the best way out of a midlife crisis is to buy a Harley-Davidson. They're going to need lots of help, lots of consumption scaffolding along that identity construction as a dangerous rebel. And if you, in this way, sort of flip your perspective on what entrepreneurship is, not, of course, for all entrepreneurs, but probably for an increasing share of them, it becomes clear that we're committing a compositional fallacy when we continue to assume that entrepreneurs saying that they're innovation-driven means that, in fact, that's what they are, when, in fact, many of the people who are claiming to be innovation-driven entrepreneurs are, in fact, quite Veblenian about it. They're play-acting that they're innovation-driven, but they're really mostly in it for it to feel good about themselves and to do the kind of identity work that you can do once you claim that you're an entrepreneur. Now, in the paper, we spent some time talking about all the ways that Veblenian entrepreneurs fundamentally just differ from the innovation-driven entrepreneurs that they emulate. A little bit like how the wealthy dentists climbing Mount Everest aren't the same kind of intrepid mountaineers who did so first. They're all climbing Mount Everest, but they're doing it for very different reasons, and their chances of succeeding are also just ridiculously different. Their entrepreneurial process basically has nothing to do with identifying opportunities, and this has everything to do with talking the talk, looking the part, hanging out with similar others, and doing conspicuous identity work propped up by the products marketed by the entrepreneurship industry that signal that they are real entrepreneurs. And the fact that entrepreneurship is so risky is actually unlikely to succeed at the outset. Only makes that identity more desirable because it makes being an entrepreneur more costly, all the better to signal that one is deserving of social recognition and praise for one's courage and one's desire to take the leap that many will not take. And you should just caveat that by thinking that if you believe Nightingale and Code, the people who are not taking the leap are doing so for really good, statistically informed reasons. Now, as you might expect, especially if you maintain the image of other dream-selling companies in your mind, this kind of consumption of entrepreneurial identity has all kinds of effects on individuals. Right? The good effects are typically short-term ones. You can attach yourself to the label and consume your way to an identity, and that can be sort of a short-term confidence boost. Just like many other kinds of identity-related consumption can be. And in the case of being an entrepreneur, it can especially maybe feed into boosting your confidence if good jobs matching your actual skills are really hard to find. Being an entrepreneur, even if it's primarily for show and identity work, can be a more acceptable way to take a gap year, prolong university life if you like that, and find your bearings in life. But of course, this doesn't last, right? Eventually, people need money to live, and they need to come from somewhere, and it's probably not good for your social support system that you're spending your support system's money for pursuing a bad idea, which is really mostly about your own identity work. And certainly not going to be fun having raised a friends and family round of venture capital for your bold plan to disrupt the financial industry, only to wake up to the realization that your idea was bad and your execution skills not as good as your parents imagined. And so while entrepreneurs generally are overrepresented in the depression, anxiety, stress, and divorce statistics, just a basic reflexivity about having set out on a venture that had very little chance of really succeeding is probably going to make all those things worse. And getting a job after having failed with an entrepreneurial venture may not be as easy as some people think. Recent evidence suggests that firms are less willing to hire prior entrepreneurs and do not value the skills learned in entrepreneurship particularly highly. So you maybe shouldn't think about this as a stepping stone that you will take into a corporate job, because the chances are that the corporate jobs will pull the ladder up in front of you. The biggest concern that you might have, however, is the wider effects of this change in the nature of entrepreneurship. Entrepreneurship, despite its highly skewed effects, is important to the economy in some kind of dimension. There are innovations that impact the economy that come from entrepreneurs, that entrepreneurs were the only ones who could have commercialized. And there are sectors that rise out of entrepreneurial efforts. The threat of new entrants keep incumbents alert. But if we have a profusion of Veblenian entrepreneurship that is a priori unlikely to succeed, that may very well bring about what we in this paper term an entrepreneurial economy. Entrepreneurial with a U, not an E. And this, we claim, is an economy that seems vibrant and dynamic, with plenty of new entrants with growth intentions, but that is in reality much more about personal identity projects and lifestyle-supporting consumption. It's not so much about production. And that, again, can have a pretty long list of deleterious consequences for the economy. It might deter skilled people from entering what they see as a stigmatized category, thus dampening, in fact, the gale of creative destruction that it was meant to spur. It might make venture capital, an essential mechanism for funding entrepreneurs, work less well. It might lead to lots of poorly targeted policies. And because of all of this, it might well end up impeding the rate of technological change on which growth and economic prosperity actually depends. That certainly is the ultimate externality for an industry nominally committed to supporting entrepreneurship.